still looking at the word imaginations. And it's first, there's two words. It's logismo or logismo and dialogismo. And one is imaginations and the other is like full. It's a word that would mean that your entire life is based on what's going to happen tomorrow. Does that make sense to my communication? You're imagining how you're going to better yourself and how everything's going to be better tomorrow. And that's dialogismo, and then just plain logismo, just normal thoughts of your mind. Okay. Both of them are translated imagination. I'm not doing too well today, so.
It's fundamentally idolatry, it sounds like.
Well, it is, but it's a little bit different than normal idolatry because instead of, you remember, Israel is the only country whose day begins at sunset. and they can never look eastward for their sustenance. They always look westward to see what's the reality. But what does it mean? The nations, since the beginning of time, have always looked at tomorrow, and that's looking east for the sunrise. Israel is forbidden to look east. They have to look only west at the sunset. And again, the day, from God's standpoint, only starts when you see the end of time and space, and you look only to the west. No longer you look at all to the east. And it all has to do with how your mind works. Is that communicating in my you want some examples?
Oh, I made a comment and you said it's different. I was trying to.
Well, it's more this, that it's generally idolatry,
yeah.
But there's all forms of idolatry.
Yeah, this is idolatry that you've created in your mind. I mean, it's not a bowl of food. It's some image that you create and worship an image or you fear the image. Fear and worship are probably similar words, and you fear that what's going to happen, or you look forward to what's going to happen. In both cases, they're out of your mind, and they take you into time and space as opposed to being in the moment of worshiping God and whatever comes your way.
Well, there's looking east, cause and effect, and expectations versus looking west is reflection.
You said west is death, isn't it?
No, working west, looking west, you're denying, I mean, you're accepting that it's finished. Looking east, you expect something, positive or negative.
And your efforts can be engaged to change it one way or another.
But the point of it is, both of these are translated as the word imaginations. And let's look at, go to Proverbs 3. No, Proverbs 12, I'm sorry. Start in verse 15. We're going to read for a while, so. The way of the fool is right in his own eyes. Now, the way that we understand that is No one has ever worshipped a false god because they believe what they're worshipping is what you give importance to. Does everybody accept that? And so here, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes. Now, and again, it's and by the tense of the verbs, the way of the fool for the next step is right in his own eyes. Verse 15. But he that hearketh unto counsel is wise. A fool's wrath is presently known, or immediately known. But a prudent man covereth his shame. We are not, all of us are, as humans, we're shame-based. For some, there's toxic shame, and so nothing can be there's nothing that toxic, it's like nothing ever fulfills, nothing ever satisfies, nothing ever goes right, because they're based, everything that they do is based on hiding shame. Now, and you don't, and most of the time you don't even know that you're hiding shame. Does that communicate a little bit? That's how we spent so much time on shame for so many years. Because it is, you know, all of those things. Let's go to Mark 15.
Yeah, because
we're taking a side route here. What?
Yeah, because guilt and fear you can often forgive yourself for or turn from. But shame is so profound. And it's almost guilt and fear at levels that you almost are never able to rid yourself of, unless I guess you truly pick up the cross and die to self.
Yeah, as long, no matter who you are, no matter how successful you are. In fact, the thing that drives ambition more than anything else is shame. Because they are doing everything they can to prove to themselves that they have value and worth. I think I've told you before that for me, the one shame thing was when I was, I don't know, 6 or 7 years old, I had double pneumonia and whooping cough at the same time, and I almost died. And during that time and afterward, every time I coughed, I had a miniature bowel movement. And when you have whooping cough, it's a big deal. And that didn't bother me. I mean, I didn't, you know, it just was something. Until my father made fun of me in front of his friends because I was 7 years old and still crapping my pants, in his words. And that hit me at a level that I couldn't even know about. I didn't remember any of it. The only thing that revealed it finally was I could never understand any jokes about bowel movements or feces, or, you know, and they're endless. And so every time someone would say that, I would hide. And I just, until in one of somebody at, I can't remember who, but somebody, when we were doing those shame things, said something that triggered it. And all of a sudden, I remembered. And I can't believe it. I can't remember who said that, but I think it was Paul. But anyway, all of a sudden, boom, I understood. I saw. And I could see that my shame was covered. And that's a big deal. Especially when of things, you know, if you didn't get the proper result or response from your parents, and you, as all little kids do, you draw something, or you show it, and everybody, and you get praised for it. But if you showed it and your parents or mother or father, especially your mother, sort of dismissed it, then that became a shame thing that molded their personality. And they're endless. But we're going to look here again to see how Jesus covered the shame. And remember the text here we're reading.
So you're saying, in a way, that shame is profound inadequacy, amongst other things?
Well, I don't know. You know, each person will have their take on how it means, but you normally have to, in order for you to get the depth of what it means, you have to somehow remember or see the shame in your own life and see how that is. And that shame issue should be done in the Seder groups, not, I mean, but it's, I'm just mentioning it because of that scripture. A fool's wrath is presently known, but a prudent man covereth shame. There's only one way to cover shame, and that's to see that Jesus took the shame. But he can't take it just because he said, but there's this series in Mark shows exactly how he took it. So let's go to Mark 15, I think. Well, and again, the shame really produces the need for more and more and more imaginations. That's the tie-in.
You know, when you just said that, it's almost like all these issues of our growing up push us into living in our imaginations to where we have no reality in our life. It's all imaginary, and we respond imaginarily.
Right, that's why that's the whole point of your myth, looking east instead of looking west. Yeah. You're looking for the sunrise, the new day when you're going to get fixed.
Yeah,
you're gonna
today will be okay.
Does everybody understand that?
Our imagination is a survival mechanism, I think.
Yeah. We cover our shame with our imagination.
Let's start in verse 6. This is important. So let's start in verse 6. Now,
I just asked what chapter.
Mark 15. Well, let's start in verse 1, because that's the whole scene. And straight away in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council of the whole Sanhedrin, and bound Jesus and carried him away and delivered him to Pilate. They were trying to get out of... Anyway. And Pilate asked him, "Art thou king of the Jews?" And he answering said unto him, "Thou sayest it." And the chief priests accused him of many things, but he answered nothing. And Pilate asked him again, saying, "Answerest thou nothing? Behold how many things they witness against thee." But Jesus yet answered nothing. So that Pilate marveled. Now at that feast he released unto them one prisoner, whomsoever they desired. Now that was just a custom, that Pilate could release a prisoner to celebrate Passover. It could be whoever the people desired. And there was one named Barabbas, which lay bound with them that had made insurrection with him, who had committed murder in the insurrection. He was one of, they were trying to overthrow the Jewish government. Or maybe, no, I don't know that for sure. They were, Barabbas was, in other places it said he was a thief, but he probably, he was a zealot because he was, I think they were trying to overthrow the Roman government. But anyway. In verse 8, and the multitude crying aloud began to desire him to do as he had ever done unto them. But Pilate answered them, saying, Will you that I release unto you the king of the Jews? For he knew that the chief priests had delivered him for envy. But the chief priests moved the people, that he should rather release Barabbas unto them. And Pilate answered and said again unto them, What will you then that I shall do unto him who you call the king of the Jews? And they cried out again, crucify him. Then Pilate said unto them, why? What evil hath he done? And they cried out more exceedingly, crucify him. Now you got to see that we are the ones that are yelling, crucify him. Otherwise, you've imagined yourself in a strange, I mean, a place to keep you alive.
There's something else I just saw that I never looked at before about, it was the chief priests who had some sway over the people, moved the people, so there was some pressure on the people by the priests.
Well, they convinced, the priest convinced them to release Barabbas instead of Jesus.
I'm talking about the priest talking, causing the people to shout, crucify him.
Right.
And so there's a little, I'm just seeing a little bit more in the emotional state of the people who were stirred up by the priest. Not that, and they didn't resist it. That's part of what I'm getting to. They didn't resist, and maybe they were going to side with Jesus, but then they folded.
Well, remember the parables that we studied. We've done it often over the years. Of the 4 days from the time of the entrance of Jesus into Jerusalem, which was on the 10th day of Nisan, that's when they inspected the lamb for Passover. The the things that Jesus said in those 4 days is what caused every person to yell, crucify him, or be silent. There was not one friend. And so that, obvious, but it was, you got to hear this and see it. On the day that he entered Jerusalem for the purpose that Jerusalem would inspect the land, you got to hear this, and it's easy to see when you look at the parables. What Jesus said in that brief 4 days caused every man, woman, and child to yell, crucify him. And that's what pleased the chief priests, the Sanhedrin, because they wanted to crucify or kill him a long time ago. But the people, the people would have rebelled. But Jesus purposely pushed the buttons of every single person in those 4 days to cause every single person either to be silent or yell, crucify. And so the chief priests and the Pilate were really not, they were minor actors in this play, because it was Jesus himself who caused the entire population to crucify him. So that, and it happened so that we can ever believe that if we were there, we wouldn't have yelled, crucify him. Because you'll find if you read those parables and statements of Christ in those 4 days, everything in there is something that'll piss you off. So he pushed it to the limit. I mean, obviously, Pilate and the chief priests were part of the play, but Jesus was the subject of it, and he could have gotten off with no death. You know, if he agreed to go to Lebanon or something, or any one of a million ways, but his death had to happen for the sake of the bride.
Yeah.
All right. So, in verse 16, the soldiers led him away into the hall called Praetorium, and they called together the whole band, and they clothed him with purple and plaited a crown of thorns and put it upon his head, and they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews." Now, the Praetorium was Jewish headquarters that was on the Temple Mount, and so they finally took him to Praetorium because after the people yelled crucify him, Pilate could have overturned. He could have not paid attention to that. He could have released Jesus because he was the head of the Roman government there. Okay, everybody see that? And in verse 18, and they begin to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they smote him on the head with a reed and did spit upon him, and bowing their knees, worshipped him. Falsely, obviously. And again, if you're ashamed, if you have shame, the biggest thing that you cannot stand, which really sets the fire to the flame, I mean, to the issue of shame, is if somebody mocks you about it. And that turns the normal shame into toxic shame. So, we are afraid of being mocked. Jesus was mocked. And they compelled one Simon Cyrenian, who passed by coming out of the country, and father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. And they bring him into the palace Golgotha, the place Golgotha, which is being interpreted the place of the skull. And they gave him to drink wine mingled with myrrh, but he received it not. And when they had crucified him, they parted his garments, casting lots upon every man, what every man should take. And it was the third hour, and they crucified him. And he's not dead yet. They just nailed him. And the superscription of his accusation was written over the one thing of the cross, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two thieves, the one on his right hand and the other on his left. And the scripture was fulfilled, which saith, "And he was numbered with the transgressors. And they that passed by railed on him, wagging their heads, and saying, Thou that destroyest the temple, buildest it in 3 days, save thyself." Again, it's more mocking. "Save thyself, come down from the cross." Likewise, the chief priests, mocking, said among themselves with the scribes, "He saved others, himself he cannot save." They weren't saying he really saved anybody, but they were saying that, you understand, they're just mocking him. "And let Christ, the King of Israel, descend now from the cross, that we may see and believe. And they were crucified with him, and those that were crucified with him, he reviled them, even the two thieves reviled him. And when the sixth hour was come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is being interpreted, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And some, when they had heard him, and some of them that stood by when they heard it, said, behold, he calleth Elijah. And one ran and filled a sponge full of vinegar and put it on a reed and gave him to drink, saying, let alone, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down. And then finally he led with a loud voice. Now, there's others in there, but the point of it, they did everything that could cause him the shame so that he could take not only the sin, but the shame to the cross. But it doesn't do us any good until because what the shame and sin does, the secret shame, is it never leaves you. You continue in it because you doubt. You doubt that you can live by faith alone. Anyway, let's go back to, we get 5 minutes. Let's go back to Proverbs. Huh? All right. We'll just finish what we were starting. Proverbs 12. Where does it say he covereth his shame or he took the side?
Oh, yeah, verse 16.
We didn't even get half of it.
We read 15 and 16.
A fool's wrath is presently shame, known. My eyes are skipping words here. Yeah, 16. A fool's wrath is presently known, but a prudent man covereth shame. He that speaketh truth showeth forth righteousness, but a false witness deceit. There is that speaketh like the piercings of a sword, but the tongue of the wise is health. The lip of truth shall be established forever, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. Deceit is in the heart of them that imagine evil, but to the counselor of peace is joy. And that's the idea. You imagine evil, and that's all you can imagine from the standpoint of your mind, because unless you've brought every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and if any thought that you have doesn't stand the test of truth, then you take it captive. You cast it down. And that's what we don't want to do. Again, as I've said so often, the first man that anybody knows about that defined and understood truth was Abraham. And he came to the understanding that if anything or anyone changed with time, place, and circumstance, it wasn't worthy to give breath to or give importance to. And so when Jesus said he is the way, the truth, and the life, that's the ticket to the see and understand what we're talking about, that he is the only life. You're not even alive. He is the truth because his sayings in his life are the same I mean, they don't change with time, place, and circumstance. And he is the way, but he never gives us life. He doesn't teach us the way. He is those things. So, but, well, let's read it one more time. A prudent man concealeth knowledge, but the heart of the fools proclaimeth foolishness. Well, anyway, we'll go back there because I didn't spend enough time on that. I'm reached a point of no return. Take a big guy.